on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, getting an idea today of the kind of stories that you just might dig up if you spend some time with the more than 65 World War II veterans getting ready to take off on an honor flight from the historic runway at the former Castle Air Force Base in Atwater, California. Again, if this is the first you're hearing about Honor Flight, make sure you go to honorflight.org and find a hub near you to get involved. This isn't just a California thing. If you're listening today on the Rock of Talk in Albuquerque or any of our Hometown Heroes affiliates, I promise there's a way to get involved in your area and give our World War II veterans a chance to experience this before it's too late. Speaking of New Mexico, the man we've been hearing from, Norris Jernigan, still has a piece of glass produced by a bomb test there in New Mexico. Not too many of us have a souvenir quite like that. We've heard how crucial secrecy was as he trained as an intelligence officer with the 509th Composite Group, preparing to deploy a weapon that then-Colonel Paul Tibbetts told the group would shorten World War II by 2 years. And 2 years is about how long you'd been in the Army Air Corps when you headed to the Pacific.
We arrived on Tinian on Memorial Day, 1945, on the troops. Well, it wasn't really a troop ship. It was one of the victory ships. And of course, we got into a real strong storm between Seattle and Honolulu. We thought the ship was going to break up because we had 40 and 50 foot swells and we were all sick.
You hadn't had any Navy training.
None at all. I didn't have my sea legs until after, once the ship stopped in Pearl Harbor, got your bearings again. I was okay then for the rest of the trip on out to Tinian.
And it's pretty amazing that this tiny little strip of land, 39 square miles in the Northern Marianas, that tiny Tinian was going to be the launching point for something that would change the entire world.
We knew it was going to be significant bomb drop scales. We felt like we were over there for a real purpose. Thought we were some kind of weirdos out there with 15 airplanes with no armament, just a tail gun, and out there to win the war. And of course, because of the nature of our unit, it had full priority for everything that we needed when we arrived on the island. Well, that caused resentment from the other groups who struggled through mud, sweat, and tears to begin with, you know, to establish bases over there and so forth. So we weren't too popular when we arrived. As soon as our flight crews arrived, they started flying practice missions. And in July, then, they started flying practice missions to Japan proper using what we called the pumpkin, which was the casing for the plutonium bomb. And it was a 10,000-pound bomb also, but it was TNT. It did a lot of damage, but not near what the atomic explosion would do. My job when I got overseas was to assist the air sea rescue officer. He was responsible for briefing the crews when they were going to fly over water, where all the submarines would be, where all the Navy fleets would be, so that if they had to ditch, they could possibly be picked up. And we received a teletype every day. That's the forerunner to the computer that told us the position of all the submarines in the Pacific and also where the fleets were, so that when the crews were briefed for that portion of the briefing on the air sea rescue, you tell them if you could fly to this grid, longitude, latitude, put out your distress signal, the possibility of you being picked up is very great. Fortunately, none of our airplanes got shot up.
And I imagine there was a lot of anticipation there. You've been training for the deployment of this top secret weapon, but so far, nothing's happened.
We were beginning to wonder if it was all just a hoax and that the pumpkin was actually the gimmick we've been talking about all this time. But then along about August 4th, 5th, all these other personnel started showing up. And I recall one time I was sitting talking to a gentleman next to me, And he was very friendly, just a nice guy, much older than I was at the time. I was only 20 years old. I had my 20th birthday on Tinian. And then I happened to glance around and look at his shoulder, and he had a star on his shoulder, which meant it was General. And it was General Farrell, who was much involved in the Manhattan Project.
And I bet there were a lot of people who started to come out of the woodwork there because of the special nature of what you all were working on.
They weren't in civilian clothes. They would be in khakis, but no stripes, no designation, no officer indication on their lapels. So we knew that they were not military, but they were some of the scientists that had been working at Los Alamos came for this occasion also. A couple of days before, when all these heavy briefings started, we didn't have one briefing in one place. They were moving them around to different places for different phases of the briefings. And, of course, our particular briefing was in the chapel, as I recall. That's where they did the general briefings as a rule. But all these special briefings with high-ranking personnel there, and, of course, Colonel Tibbetts was in on all the briefings. So we knew that something big was coming, and this is finally going to be it. Then the orders came through to go ahead and fly the mission. And of course, we learned later that that order came from the president.
Yeah, President Harry Truman, who didn't even know about the Manhattan Project until he assumed the presidency upon FDR's death just a few months earlier. That still amazes me that he had no idea, and then all of a sudden he had to make that fateful decision. What did you expect to happen? Did you have any idea what this gimmick, as you called it, was capable of?
No, I really didn't. I knew that it was going to be a very devastating bomb, but until we saw the strike pictures of what used to be a very large city, 60% of it, nothing but flat, bare ground, you knew something happened.
Now, I've read, and you can confirm this or correct me on it if I'm wrong, but Paul Tibbetts, of course, named the plane for his mother, Enola Gay Tibbetts, but I've read that that didn't happen, the naming of this B-29, until the night before the mission to Hiroshima?
The afternoon before, they painted it on there. The co-pilot, Captain Bob Lewis, when he saw that name on there, he blew his stack and went to the colonel to say, "What in the world is that name on there?" And I guess the colonel set him straight that that was in honor of his mother. You see, when Tibbetts was in college, he was destined to go to medical school, and he just was enamored with flying. He wanted to fly an airplane, and he knew if he went into the Army Air Corps at that time, he could probably become a pilot. And his mother told him, "Well, Paul, if that's where your heart is, go for it." So he always had great respect for her after that, that because of her encouragement, he was able to go into the Army Air Corps and become a pilot, and he was a very successful CO of a bomb group over in Europe before he ever came back to fly out the bugs of the B-29, and because of his record, that's why he was selected to organize this group, train them, and fly that first mission.
Of course, that mission on August 6, 1945, would drastically alter world history. And in the years after the war, I'm sure you got a sense for the burden that Paul Tibbetts bore, having been the pilot of the plane that dropped that atomic bomb on Hiroshima.
He would come to our reunions sometimes, but early on in the reunions, every time he showed up, somebody was shoving a microphone in his face saying, "Aren't you sorry for what you did?" And I just liked the words that he gave somebody somewhere along the line. I have a thing here that says General Paul Tibbetts' reflections on Hiroshima. "The morality of dropping that bomb was not my business. I was instructed to perform a military mission, and that was the thing I was going to do to the best of my ability." It's true that the two bombs together took a lot of lives and a lot of innocent lives. That's true. However, I feel that it did shorten the war by a great deal. I don't know if it was 2 years or not. But early on in November, an invasion of Japan proper was scheduled. And that would probably have been the bloodiest battle in the world's history, because the Japanese people would have defended their homeland to the last person, I feel sure. They were instructed to do that, and I am certain that they would. So we would have lost millions on both sides. There's no question in my mind about that at all. Even though the bomb was terrible, it took a lot of lives, it saved a lot more lives than it took. And another interesting fact is that the lives lost on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were not as great as the lives lost when they were doing firebombing on Tokyo.
That's important to note, and I'm sure a lot of people are hearing that for the first time. And when this mission occurs, the Enola Gay drops this bomb, little boy, on Hiroshima. The B-29 then flies back to Tinian, where you are, and Tibbetts told you all what had happened?
As soon as he arrived back in our area, our group area where we were housed, he called a meeting of everybody, stood up on the podium and said, "We flew our mission, we sighted a city, and destroyed same." And that was about right, because 60% of Hiroshima was bare ground after that.
Wow.
Yes.
When you saw those pictures, were you absolutely stunned?
In a sense, I was, and yet, from what he had said, I more or less expected that that would be the case, yes. And, of course, this was a long time coming. It all started in 1939 when Albert Einstein wrote a letter to President Roosevelt saying that it might be possible to develop a bomb from nuclear reaction. And that's where it all started.
The Manhattan Project.
The Manhattan Project, yes.
And most people know the names Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but I imagine that there are a lot of people listening right now who have never heard that a third city was nearly devastated in the same fashion.
The third bomb was scheduled for Kokura. The first bomb drop, we always had an initial target and a secondary target on every mission. The first mission, the initial target was Hiroshima, the secondary target was Kokura. On the second mission, the initial target was Kokura. The secondary mission drop was Nagasaki. Because Kokura was completely covered with clouds and they were instructed not to bomb by radar because of the expense of this project, they couldn't afford just to take a chance on it, they had to bomb visually. So they flew to the secondary target, which was Nagasaki. The third bomb was scheduled to leave the stateside and be flown over there to be dropped on Kokura. And I'm not sure which of our crew members, which crew would have dropped the next one.
Well, I think we're all glad there never was a next one. And we're all thankful we could hear that firsthand account from Norris Jernigan of Visalia, California, who was part of that whole top secret project. And we're thrilled that Mr. Jernigan is headed to Washington, D.C. to experience the National World War II Memorial with dozens of other veterans. And I don't know if there's any veteran on that flight who is more excited about the fact that it's leaving from the former Castle Air Force Base than a man who retired from that base as a lieutenant colonel after 27 years in the Air Force, serving in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, not to mention the Cold War. His name is B.A. Hansen. He's now 91 years old. He caught the aviation bug after moving from his native Colorado to Southern California, was working in the Douglas Aircraft Factory down there, and could have gotten an exemption because of that. He would not have been drafted in World War II, but he joined the Army Air Corps because he wanted to fly, and boy, has he made the most of that. He's flown just about every aircraft you can imagine, but his favorite, he says, without question, is the P-51 Mustang, which he flew in World War II and Korea. Let's find out what it was about that plane that B.A. Hansen loved so much.
Well, the maneuverability was great, but I did so many other things with the airplane. Dropped bombs, skipped bomb, did aerial gunnery, ground gunnery, and it's just a great airplane to do whatever you want.
Were you itching to get overseas and fly that plane in a serious combat situation?
Yes, we, due to the fact we knew that we were flying it, that we should do our fair share and do what we could to get there.
You got to England when? In the spring of 1945?
Yes, it was early 45, and I was only over there for a short time. I only had a few missions escorting B-24s and B-17s. I wasn't there long enough to do a whole lot, but I was there. I would like to have done much more, but fortunately we're able to finish the war, and I came home and became an instructor then. I was at Luke as an instructor on AT-6s, the advanced trainer. I did pretty good on that, I stayed there for probably a little over a year as an instructor and then went to other jobs.
But I guess it was a pretty big deal that you ended up there for that year, because if I understand it right, if you hadn't been assigned to Luke Air Base and serving as a flight instructor there, you wouldn't have met your wife? Do I have that right?
That's true. I wouldn't have met her. She was a civilian working on base, and she worked for supply. She worked down on the flight line ordering parts for the aircraft maintenance people. It wasn't long till I met her. I guess that was in late 45. And then in September 46, we got married.
September 46, so I guess about a year after you met her. Did you have to convince her a little bit that she should marry you? Was that an easy sell or a hard sell?
No, really, the way we met, I had finished my cadet class, and I was working on my car. I had a 40 Oldsmobile, and I was working on my car up near my quarters. She and her girlfriend came by. They were on their way to the BX to have lunch. Two of my friends were out watching me work on my car. When the girls came by, they whistled and hubba-hubbed. My wife said when she went home that night, she told her mother that she saw the man she was going to marry. I didn't do any hubba-hubba and whistling, so I guess that's what she liked.
Sounds like one of the wisest moves you ever made. A little self-control goes a long way, huh?
Well, after that, the next day I was finishing up on my car. The girls came by again going to lunch, and I offered them a ride, and that's how we got started. I guess I really didn't have a chance after she said she saw the man she was going to marry.
And she never changed her mind.
She didn't change her mind.
And you have five daughters and 10 grandchildren and 8 great-grandchildren who wouldn't be here had you not been such a gentleman, I guess. So good work. That's a lesson to the rest of us out there to follow your example. Time for our final break, but when we come back, more from B.A. Hansen about some of the other planes he flew and the interesting elements of his service long after World War II. Also, why Castle Air Museum is so special to him. Maybe you can meet him on the way out or the way in with the Central Valley Honor Flight from the former Castle Air Force Base next week. And keep it right here for the rest of Hometown Heroes right after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.